Fasting is our topic right now on this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and our guest is Dr. Jay Richards. He is the publisher of The Stream, kind of a Christian version of the Drudge Report, if you will. He's also a best-selling author, New York Times best-selling author, and he's a senior fellow with the Discovery Institute. He's written a new book called Eat, Fast, Feast, and he points out that Christians used to fast a lot, but now we don't very much. What happened? Jay, welcome back to the program. Great to have you back on the show. Thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure. Good to be with you, Jerry.
Okay, so why don't Christians fast these days as much as we used to?
Well, I think it's a sort of a mixed thing. I mean, part of it is that the general sort of fasting schedules that people kept for a long time and that Christians kept started to seem arbitrary. But this has really been coming for hundreds of years. If you look at what Christians did for the first several centuries of Christianity, they almost universally fasted every Wednesday and Friday and then had a little mini feast on Sunday. We kind of keep the mini feast, but we've dropped the fasting. And so a lot of it just sort of petered out over time. Honestly, I think some of it is just we find it hard, and doing hard stuff is hard. We don't like to do it. But the thing I point out in the book is that actually the way we eat, the so-called standard American diet, actually makes fasting really, really hard. So if your body's used to using either fat or carbohydrates for fuel, you're metabolically flexible. It's actually not that hard to go 36 hours or even 2 or 3 days without eating. But if you're constantly giving yourself infusions of sugar and carbohydrates and you're grazing, so you're eating 5 or 6 or 7 times a day like most of us do, that actually makes a fasting lifestyle really difficult. So if somebody just tries it once, they say, well, gosh, this feels like torture. I just can't imagine doing it. So they don't try it again.
What prompted you to even think about writing about this? I mean, you write some cool stuff. For example, you wrote Money, God, Money, Greed, and God, and that was a New York Times best-selling book. This is different. You're gone.
It is. Yeah, I mean, what's funny is, of course, this is in some ways based on my avocational interests. I've always been interested in health and fitness and spirituality. In fact, I was a strength trainer in college, and I have always, as a Christian, struggled with fasting. I mean, Jesus assumed that we had fasted. He told his disciples, he didn't command us to fast. He said, when you fast, when you pray, when you give alms. And so he took for granted that we would do it, but I always found it just almost impossible. I would do it if I felt like, okay, I really should try it, but it never seemed to have any spiritual benefit and seemed mostly like torture. It's honestly just an accident. I had a medical procedure and had to go 36 hours without eating and thought, okay, this is going to be terrible, but I had been eating a really low carbohydrate diet. And after 36 hours with no food, no calories, I felt really good. My mind was clear. I felt strong. And so I just did what everybody does. I went to the internet to find out about fasting. Lo and behold, there are now all this scientific data about the physical benefits of fasting. And so I spent a few years just investigating it, doing it myself, and finally realized, you know, it's crazy. Just about the time Christians have mostly abandoned it, suddenly health gurus in California start taking up fasting for its health benefits. And so the book is an attempt to bring together both the physical and the spiritual benefits of fasting.
Okay, why the third word in the title, eat, fast, feast?
Well, really, I think that if you look at how Christians did this for most of history, fasting and feasting were a part of the story. I mean, Easter and Christmas, for instance, are the great feast in the Christian calendar, and we retain that. And a lot of Christians know that Advent precedes Christmas and Lent precedes Easter. Some Christians kind of know about Lent and maybe give something up, but I'm convinced that actually it's that pairing that's really supposed to be a part of the Christian life, that there's a time in which we're supposed to celebrate the things that God has done and the things he's doing. That's what a feast is. We have these big feasts like Christmas and Easter, but also every Sunday is a little mini feast in which we celebrate the resurrection, but I'm convinced that we're supposed to also precede those feasts with fasting. And then when you do that, it's not only good for you physically, I think it confers meaning on the feast. It's actually lost if we basically eat our fill every single day, and then on the feast days, we just eat more than normal. We kind of lose not just fasting, but feasting itself.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's kind of funny. I remember when I was a kid, I remember giving up broccoli for Lent one year, and it was just kidding.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, broccoli, which I hate and never eat anyway. That's an easy one.
Okay, so I've got a question for you. Did it ever occur to you, and this is an interesting observation, did it ever occur to you that three men in the Bible one of whom is Jesus, who's more than just a man, but three men in the Bible that it's the only ones about whom it is listed that they fasted for 40 days and I guess 40 nights were Jesus, Moses, and Elijah. Mm-hmm. And they all three That's were exactly there right. at the Transfiguration.
That's exactly right. And this is exactly, it's the sort of thing, Jerry, that if you read the church fathers, they talk about that sort of thing continually. And that's how we got this roughly 40-day Lenten period, is an attempt to essentially kind of mimic that. No one's ever thought that Christians were all obligated to literally fast for 40 days like Moses, Elijah, and Jesus did. Nevertheless, what did Jesus do right before he started his earthly ministry? He went into the desert and he fasted and prayed for 40 days. It's as if it's like a boot camp, the mother of all boot camps before this great spiritual warfare, which he's going to battle the principalities and powers. Daniel himself also fasted after a fashion, you know, in two different periods. He abstained from everything but vegetables for 3 weeks. And then after 3 weeks, St. Michael shows up and said, I wanted to come, you know, earlier. There were some some holdups because essentially the principalities and powers were preventing me. And there was this implication that praying and fasting together can give our prayer power that it for some mysterious reason lacks when we don't fast. And so I really think part of the problem with the church is that we have given up this tool that ought to be a part of our toolkit or our arsenal for spiritual warfare.
Can you go ahead and give us some specific concrete examples, you know, for fasting that are realistic and that it not be kind of an all or nothing? Well, you know, this person fasted for a whole day or whatever, but this person, you know, fasted a meal and it changed things, you know, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, we tend to think of either the extremes, and like a full day fast might seem extreme to someone that's not ever done it, but it's really not. If you've got a fasting lifestyle, going a day without eating is really not a big deal. But I know if you haven't done it, it feels really hard, and it is. And so in the book, I actually lay out a 6-week plan in which you first just start by getting your body using fat for fuel, because for kind of complicated metabolic reasons, you need to be able to do that to keep your blood sugar steady and to feel right. So you just eat ketogenically for a week, which just basically means a lot of fat, very little carbohydrates, so your body starts learning how to use fat for fuel rather than storing it. And then once you do that, then you start limiting the amount of time during the day when you eat. So you start just by eating all your meals within an 8-hour period. Then you're going 16 hours out of the 24-hour day without eating, you know, and most of that is when you're asleep. And then you limit it to a 4-hour window, and then a 1-hour window, which means you eat about as much as you want in an hour, and then you go 23 hours without eating. And then you're really prepared for doing a full, you know, 36 to a 72-hour fast. But I really discourage people that have never tried this from trying to go 1 or 2 or 3 days without eating. Now, you could do it if somebody locked you up and just gave you water and didn't give you any food, but it would really be miserable. And my goal is to help people integrate fasting so that it becomes a permanent spiritual practice and a part of your lifestyle, rather than to try something that feels torturous and then never try it again.
Yeah. Explain the 8-hour window as a specific concrete, and go ahead and give me times of days that you're talking about.
Yes, absolutely. And so if you think of this, it's often called intermittent fasting or time-restricted eating. But what we know is that your metabolism adjusts based upon how frequently you eat. So if you eat the same amount of food, like all three meals and snacks, everything you normally eat, but you limit it to an 8-hour period, we know that's the kind of first threshold in which you're going basically most of a 24-hour day in a fasted state. And so that's going to have specific effects on your blood sugar, on your insulin. Your insulin levels go down, and insulin is a little signaling molecule that basically tells your body whether to use sugar or fat for fuel. And so if you keep it down low by going most of the day without eating, your body gets used to using fat, and it levels out your blood sugar. And so that's the first thing. Most of us, frankly, eat for 16 hours out of the day from the minute we wake up until the minute we go to bed. And then we go about 8 hours without eating, which is just when you sleep. So if you just start by flipping that, go 8 hours out of the day, either, you know, you can go from noon until 8 p.m. or 2 p.m. to 10 p.m. or whatever. You just make sure that it's within an 8-hour period and you don't eat outside that window. That's really the first step in developing a kind of robust fasting lifestyle that can be something that you do permanently. So maybe you fast a day or two a week, and then you even get more rigorous fast during Lent and Advent and things like that.
Okay. What about like 8 a.m. to 4 p.m.? you know, as an example. And the reason I mention that is because I definitely subscribe to that theory that breakfast is the most important meal of the day. It's, in fact, I've noticed, just this is just purely anecdotal, just like, you know, the only people who seem to drink Diet Cokes are fat people. Sorry, but it just seems to be the case. That I've noticed that a lot of the people who are really, you know, overweight, they tend to avoid breakfast. So I'm a big believer in breakfast. So what about 8 a.m. to 4 p.m.? Would that be
feasible? Yeah, you could absolutely do that. But I have to tell you, Jerry, before I really looked into this, I did the same thing. I spent years forcing my children to eat breakfast when they first got up. And it turns out it's just essentially a myth. There's no scientific evidence of this at all. It is true that there's a kind of healthy user bias. So if everyone is told that something is healthy, then even if it doesn't actually make any difference, most healthy people will do that and unhealthy people won't do it. But it doesn't tell you what's actually going on in the physiology. There's no scientific evidence that it's beneficial to eat at certain times of the day rather than other times of the day, as long as you're getting your basic needs met. We do know that it's generally kind of a bad idea to eat right before you go to bed. But whenever you kind of do it, as you said, you could do it from 8 a.m. until just the middle of the afternoon. Most people find it easier when they're first doing this, though, to delay eating for a few hours rather than, say, stopping eating at 2 p.m. and then not going to bed till 10 p.m. People tend to fail. And so in general, it's easier for people when they're first doing this time-restricted eating to just shift their breakfast to a little later in the day.
When I don't know if you exercise, it sounds like you do.
Absolutely.
But it would be hard. I mean, my choice for exercise, the best time for me is in the morning because then I get it over with and I tend to, you know, stick with the plan. But I definitely want to eat before I exercise and eat after I exercise.
Yeah, well, again, Jerry, I mean, I hate to tell you, but you're on the standard American diet, and so that's how your body's going to respond. But I'll tell you, I work out every day, fasted, and there's actually a lot of good evidence for fasted eating. It tends to recruit the fat from your body for fuel preferentially. It tends to preserve muscle. So, I mean, like I said, I spent years
in other words,
college training.
I see. So, in other words, you actually have done workouts on nothing as far as food.
Oh, absolutely. I do it almost every single day. And this is what I'm telling you is completely uncontroversial for people that fast. It's just that if you're not used to fasting, generally the American way of eating means that you're almost always just using carbohydrates and using sugar for fuel. And your body's not used to recruiting either dietary fat or stored body fat for energy. And so, of course, you're going to feel listless if you try to work out under that state. But if your body's metabolically flexible, so it's accustomed to using both fat and carbohydrates, there's absolutely no problem working out. In fact, there are ultra marathoners that eat in this way and have absolutely no problem doing it.
You mean to say that there are people that run 26.2 miles, or I guess an ultra marathon is more than that, on no fuel? I find that hard to believe.
No, not on no fuel at all. See, that's the point. If you're walking around, let's say you got 30 pounds of body fat on you, right? And your body is used to using fat for fuel. It's got all the fuel it needs. It just knows how to use it. It's just that most of us are in a state in which our body stores fat for fuel, but it can't recruit it. So it needs constant infusions of carbohydrates. That's the kicker. That's the thing you have to get over metabolically, is getting your body flexible so it can do that. And I argue in the book that this is, in fact, how most people ate for most of history. So most people didn't have access to protein bars and wheat thins and things like that constantly. And so it's perfectly natural to sometimes eat a lot, sometimes eat very little, or not anything at all for 2 or 3 days. We have this kind of blessed bounty in which we have food available all the time. The trade-off, though, is a cost in that it tends to restrict our metabolism so that they're used to just working in one way.
Yeah. Dr. Jay Richards, thank you again for being with us. The name of his book is Eat Fast Feast, stream.org for more information. Thank you, Jay. All the best.
My pleasure. Great to be with you.
You too. Bye-bye.